When he sat back down in his armchair, unpleasantly warm now from Mrs. Twill's bony rear end, he found he had lost the thread of his thoughts. He felt restless and distracted. He wondered if he should take a walk. Or go grocery shopping, maybe? He was nearly out of orange juice. He rehearsed the preparations in his mind. Make a list. Collect his recyclable bags. He saw Mrs. Twill as she had looked when he'd opened the door. Her who cares posture, her garish lipstick, her unfamiliar, unwelcome, un-Eunice face. "Oh, Liam," he heard Eunice say again. "Oh, Liam," he saw in her round schoolgirl script, for she had a habit of spelling O without the H, which had lent her little smiley face notes an unexpectedly poetic tone. "Oh, I wish Mr. C didn't have that budget meeting tomorrow." Sometimes, without his say-so, the most specific memories of Eunice would suddenly swim up. Her refusal to drive on major highways, for instance, because she feared what she called the peer pressure of the drivers behind her on entrance ramps. Her tendency to talk about any subject that was on her mind, regardless of her audience, so that she was perfectly capable of asking the mailman what gift she should bring to a baby shower, and the way she had of biting her lower lip when she was concentrating on something, her two small, pearly front teeth recalling the teeth of an old-fashioned bisque doll that one of his daughters had owned. Or the harder memories, from after he'd learned she was married. "But what about our only life?" he heard her say, and it was almost a melody, a plaintive little clear-voiced song hanging in the air of the room. Why was it that he had known so many sad women? His mother, to begin with, abandoned by her husband, perennially in poor health, no solace remaining to her but her children, as she was forever pointing out to them. "If you two left me, I don't know how I'd bear it," she said. And then what did Liam do? He left her. He accepted a partial scholarship to a college in the Midwest, although the University of Maryland had offered a scholarship too, and a full one at that. How could he? All her church friends asked. Thank the good Lord for Julia. Daughters were always a comfort. But wouldn't you think Liam could stay in the same geographical area, at least? When his mother was so alone? So unfortunate. Such a victim of circumstance. A saint, in fact. As she said so often, "I just seem to put myself last, even though everyone tells me I shouldn't. I know they must be right, but I'm just made that way, I guess." Liam offered no defense. There really wasn't any defense. He reminded himself very sensibly that somebody would always be saying something disapproving. No point letting it get to him. Funny. It used to be so simple to sum his mother up. But now that he looked back, he seemed to be ambushed by complexities. He saw again the frightened look in her eyes when she was going through her last illness, and her tiny curled hands. It struck him that life in general was heartbreaking, a word he didn't toss off lightly. His girlfriends had been sad types as well, not that he had consciously chosen them for their sadness. Sooner or later, it seemed, every girl he dated ended up revealing some secret sorrow. An alcoholic father, or a mentally ill mother, or, at the very least, an outcast childhood. Well, who knows? It could be that the whole world was that way. Millie, though, Millie was his golden girl. She was tall and slender, with a veil of straight blonde hair, and a beautiful pale face. Her eyes were deep-set and startlingly light in color, the lids luminous as eggshells, and she had a floating, sashaying style of walking. "Millie," he thought now, "forgive me. I'd forgotten how much I loved you." His first glimpse of her had been at a friend's apartment. She was playing the cello in an impromptu, very inept and cobbled-together string quartet, which was making her laugh. She laughed with her hair tossed back, her body loose and relaxed, her knees spread open to accommodate her instrument. This was misleading, as it turned out. Millie was not an open-kneed kind of person. She wasn't even a cellist. She was a harpist. Liam learned later that she'd gone a few months earlier to pick up a skirt from the cleaners, but the cleaner had closed for lunch hour, and so she'd stepped into the music store next door and bought herself a cello instead. That was Millie for you. Whimsical. Fae. A sort of water maiden. Liam had fallen head over heels. He had pursued her single-mindedly until she agreed to marry him, less than 6 months after they met. Had he been too insistent? Had she harbored some misgivings? He hadn't thought so at the time, but now he was less sure. At the start of their marriage, he had believed she was content, though always, now that he looked back, rather muted, a bit remote. It was true that she was not an enjoyer. She seemed to find sex something of a trial, and she deplored the excessive notice that other people, even Liam back then, paid to food and drink. In fact, she soon became a strict vegetarian, which made her even more pallid and translucent looking. But the major change dated from her pregnancy. This was an unplanned pregnancy, admittedly, but not the end of the world. They were both in agreement on that. When she started sleeping too much and grew even more disconnected from everyday life, well, it was only to be expected, wasn't that so? But then she didn't change back again after the baby was born. Or maybe she'd been that way all along, and Liam had just lacked the wisdom to perceive it. Like being dragged down by the ankles into a swamp, that was how his life began to feel. Millie was already submerged, and he was struggling to support the weight of her. Of course, the university psychologist was consulted, but Millie said he didn't know what he was talking about. And so that had come to nothing. And then, for a brief time, her doctor had conjectured that she might be suffering from a silent form of appendicitis, some chronic low-grade infection that would explain her constant tiredness and lack of zest. Both of them, Millie too, it saddened Liam now to recall, had been almost giddy with relief. Oh, then, just something medical, something curable with surgery. But that theory had been discounted by and by, and she had returned to dreary hopelessness, barely slogging through the days. Often Liam would come home in the evening to find her still in her bathrobe, the baby straggly-haired and fretful, the apartment smelling of soiled diapers, the sink piled high with unwashed dishes. "Oh, Lord, just go ahead and die," he'd thought more than once. Not meaning it, of course. Could it be that underneath, he had guessed ahead of time that she might take those pills and had done nothing to prevent it? No, he didn't think so. But he had to admit he had blamed her for her unhappiness. He had felt a kind of superiority. He had wondered why she didn't just pull herself together, for God's sake. The old woman from the apartment next door stepped out into the hall as he came home one evening. She said, Mr. Pennywell, that baby has been crying since morning. Every now and then it gets quiet, but then it starts crying again. Since 8 o'clock in the morning, and its voice has gone all croaky. Twice I rang your bell, but nobody answered, and your wife has got the door locked. Well, thanks, he said, not feeling thankful in the least. Interfering old Biddy. He couldn't be expected to do everything. He let himself into the apartment, and then he thought, since 8 o'clock in the morning? He had left for his carol in the library shortly after 7. Millie had been a humped shape beneath the afghan on the living room couch. She often got out of bed at night when she couldn't sleep and watched old movies on TV. He had switched the TV off and left without trying to wake her. 8 o'clock in the morning, he thought. And he stood frozen, not even breathing, hearing the great, hollow, echoing silence beneath the baby's hoarse sobs. People said, trying to be helpful, "It's only natural to feel angry." But Liam shrugged them off. "I'm not in the least angry," he said. "Why would you think I was angry?" Instead, he was very brisk and efficient. He devoted the first few weeks to finding childcare, juggling work and a baby. He did love his daughter, or he felt attached to her, at least, or at least he felt deeply concerned for her welfare. Still, his favorite daydream from that time was the vision of himself sitting alone in an empty room for hours and hours and hours, uninterrupted, undisturbed, unneeded by a single human being. "But I'm doing fine," he told friends. "Never better." He saw the adjustment in their expressions, a sort of clicking over from solicitous to shocked to carefully neutral. "Well, good for you," they said. They said, "It's wonderful you're able to get on with your life this way. Put it all behind you. Very healthy." He and Xanthi moved back to Baltimore in the fall. It was an admission of defeat. He was learning just how much rearing a toddler could take out of you. He rented an apartment not far from where his mother and his sister lived, and he started teaching at the Fremont School. A come-down, no doubt about it. At his university, he'd held an instructor's position, and he was starting his dissertation. At the Fremont School, he taught history, not even his field, only peripherally related to the philosophers he loved so much. But it was a very prestigious school, and without any education credits, he felt lucky to have been hired. He put Xanthi in a daycare center that seemed to be closed more often than it was open. It observed holidays he didn't even know existed, which meant he was always scrambling to find sitters. He relied heavily upon his mother, inadequate though she was, and a few older black women provided by an agency. Xanthi endured these patchy arrangements without objecting, in fact, without reacting in any way whatsoever. She was a stolid child, solemn-faced and watchful and very obviously motherless. Somehow she gave off a visible aura of motherlessness. Her lack of a mother was so pathetically apparent that women took one look at her and turned into crazy people. They brought Liam muffins and cookies and giant country hams. They stood at his door, smiling dazzlingly, offering to tidy his place a bit, and wondering if his daughter had any particular food preferences. Xanthi ate barely any food at all. He didn't know how she stayed so chubby, as little as she ate. These women had extra circus tickets and free passes to Disney movies. They knew of a special spray that would ease the tangles out of little girls' hair. They loved, loved, loved having picnics on Cow Hill. Liam himself hated picnics. He hated the two spots of dampness that always developed on the seat of his trousers, even in the driest weather. He seemed to be a magnet for mosquitoes. And it took so much effort to rise to these women's high pitch. They were all of them, every last one of them, full of gaiety and enthusiasm. He sat by their checkered tablecloths, feeling like a puddle of a man, sunken and speechless, next to his speechless child. Barbara, on the other hand, had required nothing of him. He got to know her when he started eating lunch in the school library in order to avoid the other teachers, two of whom were picnic ladies. Of course, eating in the library was not allowed, but his lunch was unobtrusive, a slice of cheese, a piece of fruit, and Barbara pretended not to notice. At the time, she was in her early 30s, a friendly, pleasant-faced woman, a couple of years older than he, not someone he gave any special thought to. Generally, she left him to his own devices. Or they would have, at most, a brief conversation about some book he'd slipped at random from a shelf. She wasn't at all like the others. Through his first year there, and half of his second, he plodded along in his comfortable, undemanding routine. Fall semester, spring semester, fall semester again. Young students who were likable enough, by and large, and who occasionally showed a spark of interest in his lessons. Lunches in the library, with Barbara stopping by his table to exchange a few words, or occasionally settling for a moment onto the chair beside his. She knew the bare facts of his life by now, and he knew her facts, such as they were. She lived alone on the third floor of an old house on Roland Avenue. She had a father in a nursing home. She found her job very congenial. One day, as she was showing him a new book about the city-state of Carthage, he kissed her. She kissed him back. They were level-headed adults. They didn't make a big to-do about it. He certainly didn't feel that tremulous elation that he'd felt in the early days with Millie, but neither did he want to. He appreciated Barbara's cheerfulness. He liked her self-reliance. Oh, but probably he should have made it to do. He must have been a terrible husband. Well, obviously he had been, if you considered how it all ended. When he thought back to how Barbara used to dance at the students' proms, throwing her whole heart into Surf City and Dr. Octopus, he asked himself how he could have been so blind. She must have wanted so much underneath, and he had given her so little. All this dwelling on the past was Eunice's fault. If not for her, or the loss of her, he wouldn't be thinking about such things. In the most unforeseen way, Eunice really had turned out to be his rememberer. Kitty came back from Ocean City with skin the color of caramel, except for the bridge of her nose, which was pink and peeling. She walked in with her bag slung over her shoulder, leaving the door wide open behind her. "Poppy," she said. "Hi there." It was Sunday morning, and Liam was fixing scrambled eggs for breakfast. It took him a moment to register her presence.
"Can you give Damien a ride?" she asked him.
"Where to?"
"His mom's in a while. Otherwise he'd have to go right now with his aunt and uncle."
"I guess so." She threw her bag on a chair and spun around to return to the door.
"It's okay,"
she called in a piercing voice. So much noise all of a sudden. Liam felt a bit dazed.
When she came back, she had Damien with her. He was carrying a knapsack, and he was as white-skinned as when he'd left. "At least someone heeds the warnings," Liam told him. Damien said, "Huh?" "The dermatologist's warnings." Damien looked blank. "He lay out as much as I did," Kitty said, "but the sun doesn't affect him." Liam said, "Really?" This seemed a bit creepy, as if Damien were some sort of vampire. But he put the thought out of his mind. "Anybody want breakfast?" he asked.
"Breakfast?" Kitty said. "It's almost 11.
"I got a late start."
"I'll say you did."
"It is the weekend, after all."
"And you look like a homeless person. Are you growing a beard or something?"
"It's the weekend," he said again. He rubbed his chin. Damien said, "I could go for some breakfast."
"You ate breakfast hours ago," Kitty told him.
"That's why I could eat again."
"Not now, Damien. We've got to talk."
Liam was puzzled. Hadn't they had the whole beach trip to talk? But then he realized he was the one she planned to talk to. She stepped up to face him and said,
"Poppy, I've been thinking."
He braced himself.
"I'm thinking I should stay here for the school year," she said.
"What? Stay with me?"
"Right."
He felt a confusing mixture of reactions to this proposal. How about his privacy? How about his nice, solitary life? But also, he was conscious of an odd sense of relief. He set down his spatula. "There's not enough room, though," he said. "There's only my study."
"You're not using your study."
"I haven't been able to, might I point out."
"What would you be doing there?"
He couldn't come up with an answer. He said, "Oh, well, let's talk about this later. We've got plenty of time to discuss it."
"No, we don't. Summer's almost over."
"It is?"
"School begins in 2 weeks."
"It does." Last Thursday, a woman had phoned from a place called Bet HaMidrash and told him she had heard he might be interested in a job there. "A job?" he'd said, caught off guard.
"A job as Zayde in our 3-year-old's class?"
"Oh," he'd said.
"Okay. Would you like to send us your application?"
"Okay." But somehow, he'd been assuming he had weeks and weeks yet to do that, and in fact, he hadn't given it any further thought. "It's August," he said now, disbelievingly.
"It's late August," Kitty told him.
"Isn't that always the way?" Liam asked Damien. "Summer just flies right by." And Eunice had been merely a summer romance, if you didn't know the whole story. Damien had seated himself at the table, and he was biting into a piece of toast. Liam's toast, as it happened. He might not have realized Liam was addressing him. Kitty said,
"Summer didn't fly by for me. I was buried alive in a dentist's office."
"Well, I'll have to think this over," Liam said, stalling for time. He dished his eggs onto a plate. "Of course, it will depend on what your mother says."
"She's going to say no," Kitty told him.
"So in that case, you can't do it, can you?"
"But if you talk to her..."
"I told you I would."
"When?"
"Oh, I'll call her this afternoon."
"No, not on the phone. It's too easy for her to say no on the phone. We should go visit her in person."
Liam studied her suspiciously.
"I want her to realize we're serious," Kitty said. "You and me should drive over there right this very minute and lay out all our reasons."
What are our reasons?
We don't get in each other's hair, for one thing.
Liam said, If by that you mean that I'm more lax, then your mother is going to say that you should be with her. And she would be right.
Oops. He had sent Kitty into her prayerful maiden pose. Plop under the floor, hands clasped to her breast.
Damien stopped chewing and stared at her.
Please, 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 she said. Have I given you any trouble this summer? Have I violated my curfew by one single eensy minute? I'm begging you, Poppy. Have mercy. All I could think of at the beach was, school is about to start, and I'm going to have to go back home and deal with Mom again. It's not fair. I should get to live with you a while. I've never lived with you, not when I was old enough to know it. In my whole entire life, all I've had is this little bit of summer, July and part of August. Xanthi and Louise had lots more time than that. And it's only for a year, you know. After this, I'll be in college. You'll never have another chance at me.
Liam laughed. It seemed ages since he had laughed.
Well, he said, let's see what your mother says.
Kitty clambered to her feet and smoothed her clothes down.
Damien asked, Have we got any marmalade?
It was proof of how serious Kitty was about all this that she wouldn't let Damien come with them to Barbara's.
You would just complicate things, she told him. We'll drop you off at your mom's house on the way.
Damien said, Thanks a lot. But Kitty paid no attention. She'd already moved on to Liam.
I hope you're planning to shave, she told him.
Well, I could do that, I guess, once I've had my breakfast.
And how about what you're wearing?
How about it?
You're not planning to go out in those clothes, are you?
He glanced down at them, a perfectly respectable T-shirt and a pair of pants that he always referred to as his gardening pants, although he didn't garden.
What's wrong with them? He asked. It's not as if I'm appearing in public.
Mom will think you look not reliable.
Fine, I'll change. Just let me finish my breakfast, will you?
Kitty backed off then, but he was conscious of her hovering at the edges of his vision, fidgeting and flouncing about, and picking things up and putting them down.
Damien, meanwhile, had assumed a horizontal position in an armchair with the sports section from the sun. Every now and then he read out a baseball score to Kitty, but she didn't seem to be listening.
As Liam was shaving, it occurred to him to wonder why he had said yes to her. He didn't want this child living with him permanently. For one thing, he was tired to death of all these fruity-smelling shampoos and conditioners crowding the rim of his bathtub. And the carpet in the den had not been visible since she'd moved in there. But when he emerged, presentably dressed, he found she had washed and dried the breakfast dishes and cleaned up the kitchen. He was touched by the earnestness of the gesture, even though he knew it wouldn't likely be repeated. It was an overcast day, but pleasant enough that people were out and about on their Sunday pursuits, tooling down the bike lane along North Charles, jogging, walking, spilling forth from various churches. On the street where Damien's mother lived, two teenage boys were tossing a football back and forth, and Damien exited the back seat with barely a thanks and went to join them.
I'll let you know how it goes,
Kitty called after him. Damien lifted an arm in acknowledgement. But he didn't turn around. It was his broken arm, the cast gray with dirt by now and scribbled over with graffiti. Evidently, it didn't hinder him, though, because when one of the boys sent the football his way, he caught it easily.
On Tuesday, they're cutting his cast down
so it's not covering his elbow anymore, Kitty told Liam. And then he can drive again. You won't have to chauffeur me around after that. See how it's all working out for me to live with you?
Just don't get your hopes up, Liam warned her. I'm not sure your mother's going to go for this.
Oh, why are you always so negative? Why do you always expect the worst?
He left the question unanswered.
In Barbara's neighborhood, his neighborhood, once upon a time, green and manicured and shaded by old trees, the central fish pond was surrounded by children feeding breadcrumbs to the ducks. Strollers and tricycles dotted the grass, and blankets were spread here and there for babies to sit on. Liam drove slowly, for safety's sake. He braked to let a small group cross in front of him, two couples shepherding a little girl and a taller boy who might have been her brother.
It was the same turtle we saw last time. I know it was, the little girl was saying. And Liam wondered if it was the same turtle he and his daughters used to see. Louise always tried to pet it. She would lean so far over the edge of the pond, reaching a hand toward the water, that Liam had felt the need to grab hold of her overall straps in case she fell in. And once, Xanthi actually had fallen in, when the girls went ice skating on a winter afternoon. The pond wasn't deep enough to be dangerous, but the water had been cruelly cold. She had arrived home in tears, Liam remembered, and Louise had been crying too, in sympathy. He turned onto Barbara's street and parked in front of their old house, which was a modest, white, clapboard colonial, not half as large or imposing as most of the others. When she and Madigan married, there had been some talk of their buying a place in Guildford, but she hadn't wanted to leave her neighbors. Secretly, Liam had been glad of that. He would have felt even more rejected, more ousted, if she had moved somewhere he couldn't picture in his mind's eye when he thought about her. He was just stepping out from behind the wheel when Kitty said, "Oh, shoot."
"What is it?"
"Xanthi's here."
He looked around him. "She is?" he said. "How do you know?"
"That's her car in front of us."
"That's Xanthi's car?" It was one of those new, sharp-edged, boxy things, pale blue. The last he'd known, Xanthi drove a red Jetta. But Kitty said,
"Yep."
"What happened to the Jetta?"
"She traded it in."
"Is that a fact?" Liam said. He tried to remember how long it had been since he and Xanthi had seen each other.
"This is the last thing we need,"
Kitty said as they started up the front walk. "Why's that?"
"She's mad at me. I don't know what for. It would be just like her to take Mom's side against me out of spite."
"She's mad at me, too," Liam said.
"Great."
If Xanthi was including Kitty in this snit of hers, then it must be true that Damien was the reason. Someone ought to inform her that an entirely different person had been arrested for the break-in. Liam started to say as much to Kitty, but he stopped himself. Kitty probably had no inkling of Xanthi's suspicions. They were already at the front door when Kitty said,
"Wait, I think I hear them out back."
At the same time that Liam, too, heard voices coming from the rear of the house. They turned to take the path that led through the side yard. When they emerged from under the magnolia tree, they found Barbara and Xanthi eating lunch at the wrought iron table on the patio. Nearby, Jonah was squatting on the flagstones to draw lopsided little circles with a stick of chalk. He was the first to spot them.
"Hi, Kitty." "Hi, Poppy," he said, standing up.
"Hi, Jonah."
Liam hadn't realized before that Jonah called him Poppy. Barbara said,
"Well, look who's here."
But Xanthi, after the briefest glance, took on a flat-faced expression and resumed buttering a roll.
"You didn't use sunblock, did you?"
Barbara asked Kitty. When I told you and told you. Where are your brains? You're fried to a crisp.
Oh, why, thank you for inquiring, Mother dear, Kitty said. I had a perfectly lovely trip.
Unruffled, Barbara turned to Liam. I've got Jonah for the weekend, she said, because Louise and Dougal are off with their church on a marriage renewal retreat. Liam had a number of questions about this. Did their marriage need renewing? Should he be worried? But before he could ask, Barbara rose, saying, Let me bring out some more plates. You two sit down. No plate for me, thanks. I just finished breakfast, Liam said. But Barbara was already heading toward the back door, and Kitty was making violent shooing motions in his direction.
Go with her, she mouthed.
Dutifully, Liam set off after Barbara. It was a relief, anyhow, to leave the chilly atmosphere surrounding Xanthi. He held the screen door open, and Barbara said,
Oh, thanks.
As they entered the house, she told him, I don't think that child has the least little grain of sense. Just wait till she gets melanoma. Then she'll be sorry.
Well, we grew up without sunblock.
That's different,
she said, illogically. Liam loved Barbara's kitchen. It had never once been remodeled, as far as he knew. At some point, a dishwasher had been fitted in next to the sink, but the general look of it dated from the 1930s. The worn linoleum floor bore traces of a Mondrian-style pattern, and the refrigerator had rounded corners, and the cupboards had been repainted so many times that the doors wouldn't quite close anymore. Even the plants on the windowsill seemed old-fashioned. A yellowed philodendron wandering up to the curtain rod and down again, a prickly, stunted cactus in a ceramic pot shaped like a burro. He could have just sunk under one of the red wooden chairs and stayed there forever, feeling peaceful and at home. But here came Kitty to remind him of his mission. She let the screen door slam behind her, and she gave him a conspiratorial glance, but then wandered over to the sink, ho-hum, and turned the faucet on for no apparent reason. By the way, Liam said. He was speaking to Barbara's back. She was reaching into the dish cupboard. She wore white linen slacks that made her look crisper than usual and more authoritative. He said, I've been thinking. It wasn't clear if she had heard him over the sound of running water. She set two plates on the counter and opened the silverware drawer. I've been wondering if Kitty should stay on with me during the school year, he said. Assuming sole responsibility for the question, I've been wondering, was meant as a gesture of gallantry. But Kitty spoiled the effect by shutting off the water decisively and spinning around to say, Please, Mom. Barbara turned to Liam.
Excuse me? She said.
She would stay on at my place, Liam said. Just for her senior year, I mean. After that, she'd be leaving for college.
What, Liam? Are you saying you'd be willing to monitor her homework and drive carpool to lacrosse games and pick her up from swimming practice? Are you going to meet with her college advisor and make sure she gets her allergy shots?
This sounded like more of a commitment than he had realized, actually. He sent an uncertain glance toward Kitty. She took a step forward, but instead of going into the prayerful maiden act he half expected, she flung a hand in his direction, palm up, and said,
Someone ought to keep a watch. Just look at him.
Liam blinked. Barbara examined him more closely. She said,
Yes. What's wrong with you?
What do you mean, what's wrong with me?
You seem thinner. He had the impression that she had been about to say something else, something less complimentary.
"I'm fine," he told her. He scowled at Kitty. He'd be damned if he would say a single word further on her behalf. Kitty gazed blandly back at him. Barbara said, "Kitty, would you take these things to the patio, please?" "But..." "Go on," Barbara said, and she handed Kitty the plates with a cluster of silverware laid on top. Kitty accepted them, but as she backed out the screen door, her eyes were fixed beseechingly on Liam. He refused to give her the slightest sign of encouragement. "It's not for my sake at all," he told Barbara as soon as they were alone. "She's trying to put one over on you."
"Yes, yes. Liam, I don't want to be intrusive, but I'm wondering if your life can accommodate a teenager."
"Well, maybe it can't," Liam said. "What the hell?
You wouldn't be able to have a person spend the night with you if Kitty were there. You realize that?"
"Spend the night?
If I had known you were involved with someone, I never would have let Kitty come stay with you in the first place."
"I'm not involved with anyone," he said.
"You're not?"
"No."
"Well, the other day it seemed..."
"Not anymore," he said.
"I see," she said.
Then she said, "I'm sorry to hear that." Something in the tone of her voice, so delicate, so tactful, implied that she assumed the breakup was not his own choice. Her face became kind and sorrowful, as if he'd just announced a bereavement.
"But," he told her, "as for Kitty, you know, you might have a point. I would probably make a terrible father over the long term."
Barbara gave a short laugh.
"What?" he said. "Oh, nothing. What's so amusing?" "It's just," she said, "how you never argue with people's poor opinions of you. They can say the most negative things, that you're clueless, that you're unfeeling, and you say, 'Yes, well, maybe you're right.' If I were you, I'd be devastated."
"Really?" Liam asked. He was intrigued.
"Yes, well, maybe you're... or rather, would you be devastated even if you truly did agree with them?"
"Especially if I agreed with them," she said.
"Are you telling me that you do agree? You believe you're a bad person?"
"Oh, not bad in the sense of evil," Liam said. "But face it, I haven't exactly covered myself in glory. I just don't seem to have the hang of things somehow. It's as if I've never been entirely present in my own life." She was silent, gazing at him again with that too kind expression. He said,
"Do you remember a show on TV that Dean Martin used to host? It must have been back in the 70s. Millie liked to watch it. I can't think now what it was called."
"The Dean Martin Show?" Barbara suggested.
"Yes, maybe. And he had this running joke about his drinking, remember? Always going on about his drunken binges. And so one night, one of the guests was reminiscing about a party they'd been to, and Dean Martin asked, 'Did I have a good time?'"
Barbara smiled faintly, looking not all that amused.
"Did he have a good time?" Liam said.
"Ha!"
"What's your point, Liam?"
"I might ask you the same question," he told her.
"You might ask what my point is?"
"I might ask if I'd had a good time." Barbara wrinkled her forehead.
"Oh," Liam said, "never mind."
It was a relief to give up, finally. It was a relief to turn away from her and see Kitty approaching, matter-of-fact, straightforward Kitty, yanking open the screen door and saying, Did you decide?
We were just discussing Dean Martin, Barbara told her dryly.
Who? But what about me?
Well, Barbara said. She reflected a moment. Then she said, out of the blue, it seemed to Liam, I suppose we could give it a try. Kitty said,
hot dog!
Just conditionally, understand?
I understand.
But if I hear one word about your bending the rules, Missy, or giving your father any trouble...
I know,
Kitty said. And she was off, racing toward the front stairs, presumably to go pack. Barbara looked over at Liam. I meant that about the rules, she told him. He nodded. Privately, though, he felt blindsided. What had he gotten himself into? As if she guessed his thoughts, Barbara smiled and gave him a tap on the wrist. Come and have some lunch, she said. He forgot to remind her that he wasn't hungry. He followed her back through the kitchen and out the screen door. On the patio, Jonah had abandoned his chalk and was sitting on the very edge of the chair next to Xanthi.
We saw an animal, he shouted. You've got an animal in your backyard, Gran. It was either a fox or an anteater.
Oh, I hope it was an anteater, Barbara said. I haven't had one of those before.
It had a long nose or a long tail, one or the other. Where's Kitty? I have to tell Kitty.
She'll be here in a minute, sweets. She's packing. Liam pulled up a chair and sat down next to Jonah. He was directly opposite Xanthi, but Xanthi refused to look at him. Packing for what? She asked Barbara.
She's going to stay on with your dad.
Huh?
She's staying on during the school year, if she behaves herself.
Then Xanthi did look at him, open-mouthed. She turned back to Barbara and said, She's going to live with him?
Why, yes, Barbara said,
but now she sounded doubtful. I cannot believe this, Xanthi told Liam. Liam said,
Pardon? First you let her stay there all summer. You say, okay, Kitty, whatever you like. By all means, Kitty. Whatever your heart desires, Kitty. Little Miss Princess Kitty lolling about with her deadbeat boyfriend.
Liam said, yes, and...
When you never let me live with you, Xanthi cried. And I was just a child, and you were all I had. I was way younger than Kitty is when you and Barbara split up. You left me behind with a woman who wasn't even related to me, and off you went forever.
Liam felt stunned. He said, Is that what you've been mad about? Barbara said,
Oh, Xanthi, I feel related. I've always felt you were truly my daughter. You must know I have.
This is not about you, Barbara, Xanthi said in a gentler tone. I have no quarrel with you, but him, and she turned back to Liam. I thought I was doing you a favor, Liam said.
Yeah, right. You had your two little sisters there, and you seemed so happy, finally. And Barbara was so loving and open-hearted and warm.
Why, thank you, Liam, Barbara said. He stopped in mid-breath and glanced at her. She was looking almost bashful, but he needed to concentrate on Xanthi, and so he turned back. He said,
Epictetus says, Oh, not him again, Xanthi exploded. Damn Epictetus!
And she jumped up and began to stack her dishes. Liam gave her a moment, and then he started over. In his quietest and most pacifying voice, he said, Epictetus says that everything has two handles, one by which it can be born and one by which it cannot. If your brother sins against you, he says, don't take hold of it by the wrong he did you, but by the fact that he's your brother. That's how it can be borne. Xanthi made a tsh sound and clanked her bread plate onto her dinner plate. I'm trying to say I'm sorry, Xanthi, he said. I didn't know. I honestly didn't realize. Can't you find it in your heart to forgive me? She snatched up her silverware. In desperation, he pushed his chair back and slid forward until he was kneeling on the patio. He could feel the unevenness of the flagstones through the fabric of his trousers. He could feel the ache of misery filling his throat. Xanthi froze, gaping at him, still holding her dishes. Please, he said, clasping his hands in front of him. I can't bear to know I made such a bad mistake. I can't endure it. I'm begging you, Xanthi. Jonah said, Poppy? Xanthi set her dishes down and took a grip on his arm. For God's sake, Dad, get up, she told him. What on earth? You're making a fool of yourself. She pulled him to a standing position and then bent to brush off his knees. Goodness, Liam, Barbara said mildly. She plucked a leaf from his trousers. All around him, it seemed, there was a flutter of pats and murmurs. What will you think of next? Xanthi asked, but she was guiding him back to his chair as she spoke. He sank onto the chair feeling exhausted, like a child who had been through a crying spell. He looked sideways at Jonah and forced himself to smile. So, he said, shall we have some lunch? Wide-eyed, Jonah pushed a bowl of potato salad a few inches closer to him. Thank you, Liam said. He ladled a spoonful onto his plate. The two women returned to their seats, but then they just sat watching him. What? Liam asked them. They didn't answer. He chose a deviled egg from a platter and set it on his plate. He reached for a tuna salad sandwich that had been cut in a dainty triangle. It occurred to him that here he was, finally, dining with a couple of picnic ladies, after all. Chapter 13. At the window end of the Threes' room stood a long wooden table that was known as the texture table. Every morning as the children came in, they headed for the texture table first to see what activity had been set up for them. Sometimes they found dishpans of water and cups and pitchers for pouring. Sometimes they found sand. Often there were canisters of modeling clay, or bins of dried beans and pasta, or plastic shapes, or finger paints. Finger paints were Liam's least favorite. He was supposed to monitor the texture table while Miss Sarah peeled the newer arrivals away from their mothers, and on finger paint days he spent all his time stopping the little boys from laying tiny red and blue handprints up and down the little girls' dresses and across the seats of the miniature chairs and in each other's hair. It was Liam's opinion that finger paints ought to be abolished. Miss Sarah, however, believed that finger painting expanded the soul. Miss Sarah was full of such theories. Overly full, if you asked Liam. She seemed about 12 years old, and she wore jeans to work, and her round, freckled face generally bore a smudge of ink or chalk or felt-tip pen. She told Liam that finger painting was especially beneficial for children who were too fastidious, too uptight, as she put it. Most of the uptight ones were girls. They would tug at Liam's sleeve with tears in their eyes, with looks of outrage on their faces, and say, Zeta, see what Joshua did? Then Liam would have to assure them that the paints would wash out, after which he would steer Joshua, or Nathan, or Ben, by the shoulders to the other end of the table. "Here, try the tractor," he would say. "Run the tractor through this puddle of purple, and you can make purple tread marks." He never knew ahead of time what the texture table would hold, because his hours were 8 till 3, and the next day's table was not set up until late in the afternoon, after the cleaning staff had come through. So every morning when he arrived, he approached the table feeling mildly curious. After all, it might be a real surprise, something they hadn't encountered before, a donation from a parent or a local business. Once, it was a huge supply of bubble wrap. The children had immediately grasped the possibilities. They had set to work popping bubbles with their little pincer fingers, snap, 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 all up and down the table. Even Liam popped a few. There was something very satisfying about it, he found. Then Joshua and his best friend, Danny, conceived a plan to roll up the sheets of wrap and wring them out like dishcloths, popping dozens of bubbles at once. And from there, they moved on to setting the rolls on the floor and stamping on them with both feet.
"You're hurting our ears,"
the little girls cried, covering their ears with their hands.
"Zayda, make them stop."
Liam was baffled by the children's unquestioning trust in him. From the first day of school, it was,
"I have to pee, Zayda,"
and,
"Zayda, will you fix my ponytail?"
No doubt at this age they would trust nearly anyone, but Miss Sarah said it also helped that he didn't act all fake chirpy with them.
"You talk in a normal, grumbly voice," she said. "Kids like it when grown-ups don't try too hard."
Though she herself clearly found Liam a bit lacking. On Halloween, the texture table bore pumpkins with their tops cut off, and the children reached in up to their elbows and scooped out fistfuls of seeds and fibers. Then they drew faces on the pumpkins with black markers, because knives, of course, were not allowed. At Thanksgiving, they had gourds of all shapes and colors and sizes, some smooth and some pebbly and warty. But there wasn't a lot you could do with gourds, it soon emerged. For Hanukkah, they made menorahs out of a special clay that could be baked in a regular oven. These were just humped, glazed bands with 9 holes for candles, nothing fancy. Liam incised the children's names on the bottoms of their creations, and then, while they were having sharing time, he carried the menorahs in a cardboard box to the kitchen, where he and Miss Lashina, the cook, laid them one by one in the preheated oven. The clumsy little objects, streaky and misshapen, their holes obviously drilled by very small fingers, seemed to give off some of the children's own fervor and energy. Liam turned over an especially garish purple and green affair with 5 extra holes. "Joshua," he read. He might have known. It came as news to him that small children maintained such a firm social structure. They played consistent roles in their dealings with each other. They held fierce notions of justice. They formed alliances and ad hoc committees and little vigilante groups. Lunches were parodies of grown-ups' dinner parties, just with different conversational topics. Danny held forth at length on spaghetti's resemblance to earthworms, and some of the little girls said,
"Ew,"
and pushed their plates away. But then Hannah, first clearing her throat importantly, delivered a discourse on a chocolate-covered ant she'd once eaten, while shy little Jake watched everybody admiringly from the sidelines. At nap time, they spread their sleeping bags in rows. Hello Kitty, Batman, Star Wars sleeping bags, and instantaneously conked out, as if done in by the passions of the morning. It was Liam's job to watch over them while Miss Sarah took her break in the teacher's lounge.
He sat at her desk and surveyed their little flung-down bodies and listened to the silence, which had that ringing quality that comes after too much noise. He could almost hear the noise still.
"That's not fair." And, "Can I have a turn?"
And Miss Sarah reading A.A. Milne aloud,
"James, James, Morrison, Morrison, Weatherby, George, Dupree."
And the chink of Eunice's earring as it dropped onto her dinner plate. He had lost his last chance at love. He knew that. He was nearly 61 years old. And he looked around at his current life, the classroom hung with Big Bird posters, his anonymous apartment, his limited circle of acquaintances, and knew this was how it would be all the way till the end. King John was not a good man. He had his little ways. And sometimes no one spoke to him for days and days and days. It seemed to be expected each Christmas that he should buy Jonah a gift. This year, he settled on a jigsaw puzzle showing a mother and baby giraffe. He believed Jonah had a special fondness for giraffes. The grown-ups in the family no longer exchanged gifts. Or maybe they did exchange gifts, but they didn't tell Liam about it, which was fine with him. Louise and Dougal brought Jonah by on Christmas Eve afternoon, and Liam served instant cocoa with the kind of marshmallows that he knew Jonah preferred, the miniatures rather than the big puffy ones. Jonah seemed very big compared with the three-year-olds Liam saw daily. He was nearly five by now. He wore a Spider-Man jacket that he refused to take off. Louise said it was an early Christmas present. "We're trying to spread out the deluge," she said. "His other grandparents go way overboard."
"Well, in that case, maybe he could open my present early, too," Liam said.
"Can I?" Jonah asked, and Louise said, "Why not?"
She was sitting in an armchair while Dougal, a tubby, soft, blonde boy of a man, was squeezed into the rocker. Liam always had the impulse to avert his eyes from Dougal out of kindness. He seemed so uncomfortable in his own body. Jonah really liked his present. Or at least he said he did. He said,
"Giraffes are my favorite animals, next to elephants."
"Oh," Liam said, "I didn't know about the elephants."
"Go ahead and give him his present," Louise told Jonah.
"I have a present?" Liam asked.
"He's old enough now to learn that giving goes both ways," Louise said. "I made it myself," Jonah told him.
He was pulling it from his jacket pocket, a small flat rectangle wrapped in red tissue.
"Why don't I just unwrap it for you?" he said.
"That would be very helpful," Liam said.
Jonah was so eager that he flung bits of tissue everywhere. Eventually, he uncovered a bookmark decorated with pressed leaves.
"See,"
he said, placing it on Liam's knee.
"First, you glue the leaves to the paper, and then the teacher sticks this clear stuff over the top of them, with her hot, shiny metal thingamajig."
"That's called an iron," Louise said, clutching her hair. "I'm mortified."
"I'll use it right away," Liam told Jonah.
"Do you like it?"
"I not only like it, I need it."
Jonah looked pleased.
"I told you,"
he said to his mother.
"He insisted it was you who should get that," Louise told Liam. "I believe it was originally supposed to be a parent gift."
"Well, too bad," Liam said merrily. "It's mine now."
Jonah grinned.
"Where's Kitty?"
Dougal asked Liam.
his first utterance since high. She's a Damien's, I believe. Louise said, What do you mean, you believe? Well, actually, I know. But she's due home any second. She said she'd be here for your visit. She had promised to help with the entertaining, Liam remembered wistfully. He sometimes found Dougal a bit difficult to converse with.
That girl is running hog wild, Louise told him.
Oh, no, no. By and large, she's been very responsible. This is just the exception that proves the rule.
You know, I've never understood that phrase, Louise said thoughtfully. How could an exception prove the rule?
Yes, I see your point. Or honored in the breach rather than in the observance.
What?
That's another one that seems to contradict itself. Louise said,
When I was...
Or arbitrary, Liam said. Ever notice how arbitrary has two diametrically opposite meanings? He was beginning to find entertaining easier than he had envisioned.
When I was Kitty's age, Louise persevered, I wasn't allowed to go out on Christmas Eve. Mom said it was a family holiday and we had to all be together.
Oh, I can't imagine that, Liam said. Your mother never made a big to-do over Christmas.
She most certainly did. She made a huge to-do.
Then how about the time she gave away the tree? Liam asked.
She what? Have you forgotten? Myrtle Ames across the street came by in a tizzy one Christmas morning because her son had suddenly decided to visit and she didn't have a tree. Your mom said, Take ours. We've already had the use of it. I was in the side yard, collecting firewood, and all at once, I saw your mom and Myrtle carrying off our Christmas tree. I don't remember a thing about it. It still had all its decorations on, Liam said. It still had its angel swaying on top, and tinsel and strings of lights. The electric cord was trailing on the asphalt behind them. The two of them were doubled over in their bathrobes and scurrying across the street in this secret, huddled way. He started laughing. He was laughing out of surprise as much as amusement, because he hadn't remembered this himself until now. And yet it had come back to him in perfect detail. From where? He wondered. And how had he ever forgotten it in the first place? The trouble with discarding bad memories was that evidently the good ones went with them. He wiped his eyes and said, Oh, Lord, I haven't thought of that in years. Louise was still looking dubious. Probably she would have gone on arguing, but just then Kitty walked in, and so the subject was dropped. It didn't bother Liam that he would be spending Christmas Day on his own. He had a new book about Socrates that he was longing to get on with, and he'd picked up a rotisserie chicken from the Giant the day before. When he dropped Kitty off at Barbara's in mid-morning, though, she seemed struck by a sudden attack of conscience.
"Are you sure you'll be okay?"
she asked after she got out of the car. She leaned in through the window and asked,
Should I be keeping you company?
I'll be fine, he said, and he meant it. He waved to Xanthi, who had come to the front door, and she waved back, and he drove away. If only the roads could always be as empty as they were today. He sailed smoothly up Charles Street, managing to slip through every intersection without a stop. The weather was warm and gray, on the verge of raining, which made people's Christmas lights show up even in the daytime. Liam approved of Christmas lights. He especially liked them on bare trees, deciduous trees, where you could see all the branches, although he couldn't imagine going to so much trouble himself.
In his apartment complex, the parking lot was deserted. Everybody must be off visiting relatives. He parked and let himself into the building. The cinder block foyer was noticeably colder than outside. When he opened his own door, the faint smell of cocoa from yesterday made the apartment seem like someone else's, someone more domestic and cozier. Before he settled in with his book, he put the chicken in the oven on low, and he exchanged his sneakers for slippers. Then he switched on the lamp beside his favorite armchair. He sat down and opened his book and laid Jonah's bookmark on the table next to him. He leaned back against the cushions with a contented sigh. All he lacked was a fireplace, he thought. But that was all right. He didn't need a fireplace. Socrates said, what was it he had said? Something about the fewer his wants, the closer he was to the gods. And Liam really wanted nothing. He had an okay place to live, a good enough job, a book to read, a chicken in the oven. He was solvent, if not rich, and healthy. Remarkably healthy, in fact. No back trouble, no arthritis, no hip replacements or knee replacements. The cut on his scalp had healed so that he could feel just the slightest raised line, barely wider than a thread. His hair had grown back to hide it completely from view, and the scar on his palm had shrunk so that it was only a sort of dent. He could almost convince himself that he'd never been wounded at all. This is Arthur Morey. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Noah's Compass by Ann Tyler. This program was directed by Jill Whitesides, executive producers Kelly Gilday and Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2009 by Ann Tyler, production copyright 2009, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.